Good morning. Thank you. It's lovely to be here. As you all know and has been mentioned already, I'm not here because of any research I've done recently. I'm here because of follow up on a paper that was published 45 years ago and was written actually further in the past than that. So my role here will not be one of presenting any new research, but I will try to provide some kind of a historical perspective that, for me at least, puts the general topic of life cycle economics in a broader context. And I'd like to say that this is my subjective view of the history of our profession or of our topic, and it helps me think properly about this kind of work. But before I do that, let me tell you a little bit about that paper that Moshe has kindly referred to a moment ago. So that was actually part of my PhD thesis written at Stanford University. And my first job out of graduate school was at Yale University, and in fact, at the Coase Foundation for Research in Economics, which is a research unit at that time fairly recently moved from Chicago to Yale. And the custom there was that whenever a staff member was submitting a paper for publication, the paper would undergo internal refereeing at Coase. And I was very fortunate that the papers that I was writing up from my thesis, the internal referee for those was Charlene Koopmans. And by the way, this was not just for the young Turks. Everyone so when Charlene wrote a paper, there would be an internal referee for that when it was ready to be submitted to a journal. So when I was ready to submit three papers that came out of my thesis, Charlene became the internal referee, and we talked about and he read it and he made comments and I made some corrections, I think improvements as a result of receiving those comments, and then he and I discussed the question of submission of these papers. And two of the papers were fairly closely related. One was on life cycle planning without uncertainty, and the other was the paper that we're referring to here, life cycle economics with uncertainty, in particular with the lifetime uncertainty. So Charlene and I thought that it would be right to submit both of them together to one journal to be published, hopefully, in sequence. Okay, so the International Economic Review was selected for that, and this was one of probably the first submission I had ever made, so I sort of reveringly submitted these two papers to Lori Klein, who was then all these people eventually got the Nobel Prize. But this was before that, and he was in Japan at the time, and I submitted both papers to the IER, explaining that the topics were related and that I thought that the proper way to have those presented to the profession was in sequence in the same journal. And I waited and waited and waited and waited because Lori Klein was in Japan, as I say. And eventually I got a letter from him, and I have never received a letter like that since. That it was uh, the, uh, that he, the editor of the IER, thought that I had the nerve to take a material that was hardly worth one paper and to artificially cut it down into two papers in order to maximize the number of publications that I get out of a little piece of work, and that therefore he was rejecting both of them. So here was a paper that was rejected on the first round, and then it became known that other papers at Coles Foundation had also been rejected. So Martin Schubik, whom many of you know, I'm sure, and who has great wit, he immediately made the proposal to launch a journal called JRM, the Journal of Rejected Manuscripts, and he predicted that this would become a major journal very quickly. In any case, I was incensed, of course, and quite angry, but that's where Charlie Koopmans' good sense came in, and he calmed me down and he said, "Don't worry. What you should do is send back one half of one of the two back to Lori Klein and submit the other one elsewhere." So that's how a paper appeared 1 year earlier in the International Economic Review. And this paper was submitted to the Review of Economic Studies and appeared 1 year later. So you should know that we're talking, and to the extent that we want to refer to this paper, we are referring to a paper that's been rejected by a major journal, and we should keep that in mind. If we do a fast forward to last month, September of 2010, I got in the mail my copy of the Journal of Economic Literature, right? And there I see a long and detailed survey article by Attanasio and Weber called, let's pull out my glasses for that. Attanasio and Weber wrote a survey article about consumption and saving models of intertemporal allocation and their implications for public policy. Well, you'd think this is certainly a survey article. This is certainly one place where a reference would be made to this old piece of mine. Well, you look through, and it's not never mentioned in that extensive survey, and it's not even cited. In other words, there are hundreds of, there's a bibliography in that. That's just last month, right? There's a bibliography of that, pertaining to that topic, and this paper that Moshe has just mentioned is not even in that, is not even cited. So perhaps we're here for a quiet and final internment of this piece, and that should be laid to rest at this point, seeing that isn't that some of the experts progressed beyond it very very extensively, so as not to have to go back to referring to it. In any case, what I said earlier was that I really don't have any new research to report to you on in this area, because I haven't worked in this area for 45 years, and it would be presumptuous to try and jot down a model or something like that and present it to a group like this of probably the world's greatest experts in the area of life cycle economics. So what I thought I'd do is assume the role of kind of provider of historical perspective. And as when I say historical perspective, it's my historical perspective, but I think, or at least I'd like to convince you that it's the correct in some sense, I mean, historical perspective is not something you measure the correctness of, but that it's somehow useful to think of this whole area that we're talking about, and in particular the paper that I was fortunate to write so many years ago, to put that in historical perspective. And when I thought about that, I thought that I was able to detect a line, a historical line, in which this thing fits, or at least somewhere along that line it fits, and I'd like to describe that historical line for you briefly, and I hope it will be useful as kind of a very, very general background. So when I think of that paper, and remember it was written in the at the end of the 50s and early 60s, you think about that era in economic research and in economic theory, and you have to say, when you think of that, that this was essentially the heyday of neoclassical economics. In other words, the end of the 50s, the beginning of the 60s is where neoclassical economics finally reached its apex, and since then we've been going in other directions, like market failures, which are certainly not neoclassical in any way, or inefficiencies due to imperfect information, or things like that. But up until the middle 60s or something like that, neoclassical economics was reigning high, and it was the paradigm that people in theory, in economic theory, were working within. So when I think of that, I ask myself, we're talking about a 45-year-old paper, so we're using 45-year-old technology. I'm sorry about that, but that's how you do 45-year-old papers, right? So here we are. The way I read neoclassical economics is by citing two principles, tenets of neoclassical economics, and one of them is to derive behavior patterns. When I say that, I mean, is Canada behavior with O or with OU? I never know. In other words, when I say behavior patterns, I mean the patterns of behavior of economic agents, or of actors in the economy, from first principles. That's the first tenet. The way I see neoclassical economics. And the second tenet is reduce economic phenomena to, how did I write that? Individual behavior. In other words, to the behavior that you get under the first over here. Now, this is also called provide micro foundations for economic phenomena. But what it means really is, after you've understood the patterns of individual behavior, you better be able to relate those to the quantities that we're really interested in. And those are typically macro quantities, and those should be reducible to what you've done earlier for the individual, right? And of course, it all began in the middle to late 19th century. Jevons and Marshall are the two most cited names, but they had help from Wicksell, Walras, Pareto, and others. But it's mostly middle to the end of the 19th century, and when this tradition sort of began. But as I said a moment ago, it reached its apex in the middle of the 20th century with people like Samuelson, right? So here is Jevons, the beginners, or the initiators, not the beginners. The initiators, Jevons, Marshall, Wicksell, etc. And sort of at the end of that intellectual history, we find Samuelson with the model that Larry mentioned yesterday in overlapping generations, consumption level model. Solo with his study of growth. Arrow, De Bruyne, right? Arrow and De Bruyne both in collaboration and separately. And in collaboration, that's and others, right? That's their famous paper on the existence of equilibrium, which is sort of really a crowning achievement in neoclassical economics. And Samuelson and Solow and Arrow and De Bruyne and others. Oh, I should say Hicks. I must say Hicks, right? Value and capital. In fact, we'll talk about this in a moment. These were sort of the actors at towards the end of that tradition, and De Bruyne's book, The Theory of Value, is kind of almost taking it to an extreme, or to the absurd, maybe even to De Bruyne's book, The Theory of Value, was called the Bourbakization of economics. You know, we are in the Fields Institute. Everybody knows about Bourbaki, this group of mathematicians who set themselves the program of reducing all of mathematics to basic principles. And they actually were successful in most of it. And then Gérard De Bruyne came along and he said, well, if mathematics can do it, we can build on what they did and reduce all of economics to what they had done for mathematics. So in some sense, his book, The Theory of Value, which few people today look at or read, but it was a major kind of crowning achievement for neoclassical economics towards the end of that tradition. I should mention that it was by no means a universally accepted point of view, this neoclassical point of view. And many people in the profession, and some of them very, very renowned, were outside that, and in fact, were vigorously opposed to this whole tradition. And of course, we can talk about Cambridge, England, Joan Robinson and Piero Sraffa. And we can talk about Morishima in Japan. And Morishima actually had this idea of combining the two, in other words, of getting a neoclassical foundation for Marxian economics, which is a major feat if successful. His wasn't completely successful, but it was very, very admirable. And these three, at least, were in the Marxian tradition, which was distinctly non-neoclassical. And I won't go into that because that would take me off on another tangent, and that's not a good thing to do. How long do I have, by the way? I'm sorry.
As long as you want.
Wow. Wow, that's... Okay, so there was a non-neoclassical tradition, some of it very much alive in... mostly in Europe, not so much in the U.S. Remember, this was the period in the U.S. where, how shall I say, Marxism was very much frowned upon, so to put it mildly, right? So why should anyone pursue a Marxian agenda when you could go and do mathematics instead? So anyway, so this neoclassical tradition and neoclassical trend was the one in which papers like mine fitted. And I'd like to just briefly indicate where it fitted. And so that would provide kind of this kind of a historical background to the discussion that of today, the way I, from this point of view, 45 years ago, the way I look at it, okay? So the big question that, or one of the big questions that neoclassical economists were worried about was, why is there capital? How come there is capital? Why is there capital? That's I claim a question, or to make it more precise, why is there capital accumulation? Why does capital accumulate? Right? According to these tenets over here, you need to reduce capital accumulation to individual behavior in a systematic way in order to explain it. Right? That's simple. And so the question is, well, we did learn from Hicks right here that capital is an entity whose time derivative is investment, right? So what did we know? We knew that capital, whatever it might be, we're trying to decide that, but whatever it might be, It should satisfy this. We also knew from basically from national income accounts that investment equals savings. Actually, saving, because this is a flow, and you need the flow on the other side. So we knew that, and we also at the time thought that saving is mostly private, but that's private in the following sense, that we have consumers who save, and we have firms that save by failing to distribute the entire profit that they make. In other words, undistributed profits is is business savings. So we have these two sources, but they're both private. In particular, so undistributed profits. Government saving was very little, if any, right? I mean, government saving, to think of the government actually running a surplus in the budget and writing down surplus as government saving, that was rather far-fetched. And so saving was mostly this. And these two sources are both private in the sense that whatever consumers, that's sort of obvious, but firms, whatever firms say by failing to distribute their entire profit, goes in a sense to their shareholders, and the shareholders are once again. So take these three facts in quotes, right? That were assumed at the time, and you reach the point of saying, if we have to answer this question, why is there capital? The answer must be because consumers save, because consumers are both on this side and on this side, except that on this side they're in the role of shareholders, but they're the same. So if there's capital, it's because consumers save, and savings is equal to investment, and the integral of investment is capital, and that's how come we have capital, okay? That's the neoclassical view of capital, unlike the Marxian view and all that. And we can talk about that if need be. So if consumers save, we have to, so consumers save is the is where you start to answer this question. Why is there a capital? Because consumers save. Well, but if this is the answer, we note that consumers also dissave. But, right, consumers also dissave. Consumers also dissave. So, which is which? In other words, which will take precedence over which? And so there is this neoclassical view of lifetime planning of consumption, and that has a consumer's net worth. You know, you draw a graph which is hump shaped, right? So net worth, this is lifetime or age or whatever, and this is net worth, and you get a hump like this, where this is the period of saving, and this is the period of dissaving, and you reach capital T, which is where life ends, capital T, and we'll talk in a moment about what happens if this is random variable, but if it's just a number, that's what it is. And so this phase is where capital is built up, and this phase is where capital is eroded. Can this account for an accumulation, a macro accumulation of capital? And the answer to that is that the only way, and indeed it is valid, or it was thought to be valid, to account for that is that there are more people saving than people dissaving. In other words, the reason capital builds up is that the population grows, and at the time that people dissave, there are younger people who save, and in the steady state, they're all essentially replicas of one another, but there are more of the young ones than there are of the old ones because of population growth. And so this view of saving or of net worth building and eroding gets you the following conclusion that capital accumulation arises from population growth capital accumulation arises from population growth. And in fact, you can get theorems, and that's what people did, to show that in the limit, the capital to population ratio would be constant, or capital labor ratio, if you wish, in the models where all the population was employed and all that. So that gives you capital to population ratio constant in the limit. Well, is that good enough, or is it not? Can you see it down here? I'm sorry, I didn't realize. View was blocked here. I'll try to do better later. I can raise that. All right, more or less. Not great. Okay. But all you've got to do is look at the data and see that capital, no matter how you want to define it empirically, over centuries has been growing faster than population. So this model wasn't going to explain or to answer the original neoclassical problem of why is there capital in the sense of why is there capital that's being observed empirically. And so you had to do better than that. And that's why you say that. So for that reason, and I'll go over here, that would mean walking a lot. So the idea was that you had to assume that people assume people or consumers end their lives with positive net worth. You know, the hump-shaped net worth gets you back to zero at the end of the lifetime, as you see over there in this. So you have to, in order to explain capital beyond just population growth, you have to assume that people, or one way to handle that is to assume that people end their lives with positive net worth. Well, why is that? Why do people end their lifetime, their lives, with positive net worth? So there are two reasons classically proposed for that, and one is that they get caught, that death catches them by surprise, and so they go over to the next world where with a residual of positive net worth staying in this world behind them, so leaving that behind. So that's uncertainty of lifetime, and the other one, of course, is bequest, right? So the answer to this why is, one, uncertainty of lifetime. And the two is bequest. That's to say, the desire to pass on resources to the next generation. And that's so if you're going to do that, you have to work things so that at the end of the lifetime, something is left over for the heirs for whom the bequest is intended, right? And so this is where this 1965 paper fits. So here's kind of the, so, and this is the 1965 paper. When I write this, I don't mean that the 1965 paper settles everything that you can think of in this context, but it does mean that these two questions were the motivation for the 1965 paper that Moshe has cited and mentioned. And I must say that the 1965 paper that the main message was, well, these two things hardly answer this this problem of explaining capital through positive net worth at the end. Why? Because on the first one, you have market instruments that guarantee, or that you could use, that if you were to use these, you would end up with zero net worth at time of death, despite the fact that you didn't know when that sad event would occur. And that's the what I call there an actuarial note. An actuarial note is a very basic kind of asset from which you can build both annuities on the one hand and life insurance on the other. And if you work it out carefully, you can calculate exactly what the rate of interest should be on these actuarial notes and everything, and people would use them precisely in order not to fall into the, not to be subject to this pitfall of ending with positive net worth when you don't have any reason to do that. And so that is the first part of that paper. And the second part is about the bequests, and that is a problem, a bequest. Notice that bequests will, of course, lead to positive net worth at the end of the lifetime, of one's lifetime, but you're back to the problem that arose before, namely, in a kind of a steady state where consumers are similar over time, it would work out in such a way that bequests would once again, that the sum total of that would once again be tied to population growth. And then you're back to the previous dilemma of what to do about capital that grows faster than the population does. So these are the two problems that immediately arose from that, and also notice that the bequest motive. Using bequest motive to answer this question of why people end up with positive net worth, it also has a little bit of a methodological problem attached to it. And that is to say, Because the bequest motive actually says that people end up with positive net worth because they prefer to end up with positive net worth. That's what bequests. In other words, what you do to explain something, you simply stick it in the utility function and you got it explained. That's methodologically not a very satisfactory way. Why? Because you can explain anything in this way. You take the most irrational behavior and stick it in the utility. People enjoy this irrational behavior and you will have rationalized irrational behavior. So the idea of explaining something by sticking it in the utility function is a problem in and of itself, and it's right in there in the so-called bequest motive. So this somehow was something that made people uneasy, even if you did take the route of the bequest motive. So what do you do? And now I go beyond this 1965 paper. I go into the 70s, right? So what do you do to account for this without bequest motive, or in some sense rationalize the bequest motive in a more satisfactory, appropriate sense or way? And there comes Gary Becker in the 70s, right? What did Gary Becker say? Another Nobel laureate, right? This is a talk only about Nobel laureates. People in Gary Becker's model, they leave bequests because it's their part in a market transaction with a trading partner, right? So people leave bequests as their part in an agreed upon market transaction. In other words, what Gary Becker did was imagine that the family, that there are market transactions occurring within the family, right? Agreed upon market transaction. And who is the partner in this transaction? Who is the other trader in this transaction? It's the offspring. It's the children. So in Gary Becker's world, parents and children engage in trade. And in fact, it's market trade. And they reach a deal. A market deal, market supported deal, and that deal has to be followed, because that's how you build markets. And so let's say partners the partners in this transaction are the kids, right? And what do they offer in return? They offer care of the older generation. Whose part in the transaction is parental care, right? I think I'm being fair to Gary Becker. Is parental Now, notice that the bequest is a stock and parental care is a flow. And so you don't run into this problem that what these people do somehow negates what these people do, and therefore the sum total gets you back to zero as we had before. This can give you a positive net worth or positive resources being transferred to the next generation without any problem of having to balance that against negative transactions of stock, of capital on the other side. So that sounds good. Gary Becker have an example of a sequence of market equilibria like this that actually produces capital accumulation? Answer, maybe. I don't know. I haven't seen him do that. And so this thing is an open question of whether this model can generate capital accumulation within a neoclassical way of thinking, okay? But there's also, so I will not, maybe should I write this? Okay, no, I won't write. Because there is a more kind of piercing kind of problem with this way of thinking, and that is what if you are assuming a market, if you're assuming market transactions between parents and their offspring, then you have to ask the question: what kind of market is it? So I will end soon. So what kind of market is it? So there are two possible answers. One is competitive. And the other one is non-competitive, right? That's the principle of the excluded middle, right? So if you talk about a market that gives rise to this accumulation, what kind of a market is it? Well, competitive it cannot be, because competitive markets assume that the traders are small relative to the market at large, right? And parents and kids are the only traders here. So the traders are not small. So it must be non-competitive, but if it's non-competitive, then it becomes a game. In other words, an interaction between, let's say, parents and children or any other traders in a one-on-one kind of market is a game. And so the solution of that has to be a solution of a game or a resolution of a game situation. And when you write down what this game is, or what presumably it would be under Gary Becker's kind of way of thinking, you come up with a prisoner's dilemma. In other words, a game where it's optimal for both sides, for the parent not to support the child and for the child not to support the parent. And I'm running over time a little bit, so I will not write the game for you. Now, this game, A Prisoner's Dilemma, has the equilibrium that nobody cooperates. In other words, the parent doesn't support the child, and the child doesn't support the parent. But you look at how people in laboratory situation, as well as in the real world, wherever that kind of thing is observable, you find that nevertheless people do cooperate in this kind of game. In other words, they would leave bequests on the one hand and support their elders on the other. But then you're down to the question of, do you want to rationalize capital accumulation through irrational behavior in the prisoner's dilemma? That sounds a little awkward and something that ought to be avoided. And that's where recent research of mine comes in. And if there is a chance later on, I will be delighted to bring you in on that, because I think I have a way of looking at prisoner's dilemma type games and others where it's actually rational to cooperate on both sides. Not completely, but let's say with high probability. And that takes us beyond the scope of today's discussion, so I will end right here. Thank you very much.
Well,
you're forcing me to. Okay, so let's do it here. So we have parent over here, and we'll do it symmetric, even though it isn't, and all that, just for. So if you put parent here, then